Eveen and Company with Eveen Ihoilewan on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning and welcome. My name is Eveen Ihoilewan and over the coming weeks, I'll be with you at 10 on Sunday mornings here on RTE Radio 1. I'll be in your company for what I hope will be good conversation and great music. And my guest this morning has broken the habit of a lifetime and got out of bed before 12 o'clock in the day to join me in studio. Like myself, he's from County Mayo. By day, he's Rory O'Neill, but by night, he is the outrageous and slightly bold Panty, one of Dublin's drag queens. This week and next, his new show, All Dolled Up, Restitched, runs on the Peacock stage at the Abbey Theatre here in Dublin. So good morning, Rory. You're very welcome to the studio.
Hi, Eveen.
Rory, you're best known as your alter ego Panty. Mm-hmm. Big hair, big makeup, big shoes. Just for people who aren't aware of her yet, how can you describe her to me?
She is larger than life. She's glamorous. Her influences come from various places, but I guess the biggest one is the movie The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. So she has a sort of a glamorous but sort of slightly buttoned down school marmy quality. She has been performing in nightclubs and that kind of thing for 25 years or so.
And tell me about The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, that movie. Who's the actress in that?
It's Maggie Smith, and she won an Oscar for it. And it's based on a book by Muriel Spark. And the central performance by Maggie Smith is amazing.
Because she's outrageous in the movie. She's supposed to be a school mom, but she's having an affair with a married man.
Yeah, she's a school teacher in a very buttoned-down girls' school in 1930s Edinburgh. And everyone around her is very sort of grey and prim and proper. And she, you know, she's all interested in art and beauty and all of that. So she has this glamorous quality. She's sort of in technicolor while everybody else is grey.
And is that how you would describe Panty then? That she's just so colourful and vivid in comparison to the rest of
Well, I think drag queens in general, you know, they're bigger, aren't they? You know, they're big sort of living cartoon characters in a way. I mean, sometimes I think people think that drag queens are sometimes, you know, female impersonations, but they're not really. They're almost something else on their own. They're characters that are designed specifically for entertainment purposes, and in that respect, they're bigger than life.
And what are people's reactions to Panty when she's out?
Well, it's an odd one, because she's very big and, you know, larger than life, and sometimes people are a little intimidated. And I think drag queens have this reputation for being sort of, you know, bitchy, if I can say that at this hour of the morning. So some people are a little intimidated. But in general, what I find is that people relate to drag queens in a very open way. I sometimes think it's because people think you're not going to be shocked or judgmental. I mean, they figure, oh, there's a guy standing around in public dressed as a woman. And in some way, certainly in our culture, that is seen as something odd or, you know, something that sort of puts you low down on the social ladder, sort of. So in a way, I think they feel that they can be really open with you, that you're not going to be shocked. So, like, people do have a tendency, maybe especially if they have a drink on them in a nightclub or something, you know, they'll come up to you and tell you really incredibly impersonal things about their lives. Sometimes things that they've never told anybody.
Tell me what else Panty can do that Rory can't do then.
Because you're an entertainment character, in a way you're kind of a cartoon, people will allow you to say things to them that you could never just say to them on the bus.
Like what?
You can make jokes with them. You can say the kind of things that people would be insulted by if an ordinary person said it to them. But when it's coming from a big cartoon, they take it much lighter. You know, they'll see it, understand it as a joke.
Is Panty braver than Rory?
Yeah, well, I think as a boy, you know, I'm probably odd, in a weird way, sort of shy. I mean, I'm not shy. I'm the kind of person who can go into a party and not know anybody and chat away happily. But I'm not the kind of person who, in a way, draws attention to themselves. And, you know, if I'm standing in the corner of a bar, nobody would really notice me. You know, I'm just... But, of course, everybody notices Panty. You can't help but notice her because she's big and shiny. And, you know, Panty is basically parts, elements of my character exaggerated, while other parts of my character are dampened down.
And is that what attracts you to being Panty, that she is outrageous and she gets all that attention, but it's not quite you that's doing that?
That's definitely a part of it. I think to be an actor, you really have to be able to lose yourself, you know, to hide your own ego or something. And I don't think I really have that ability. Well, with Panty, you have this mask on, and so it's very freeing. It definitely gives you kind of maybe a bravery to get up in front of people and do things and say things that I would feel very exposed saying or doing if I was just wearing a t-shirt.
But saying that you don't feel like you're an actor, Rory, you've now been accepted to play at the Abbey Theatre. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, but in my mind, I'm not acting. I'm just playing Panty. You know, it's the only role I ever play, in a way. And like I said, Panty is so interconnected to me that I don't feel that it's an acting job in the same way. I think maybe people outside of the sort of drag world or people who haven't much interaction with drag queens, they find that difficult to grasp, that the drag character is so connected to the person underneath the makeup. Say Mrs. Brown.
Yes.
She's not a drag queen.
Why isn't she a drag queen?
Because he's an actor or a comedian playing this role that happens to be female. But I think Mrs. Brown, in a way, has been created to exist within this artificial world. So Mrs. Brown exists within the world that's presented to us in the TV show or on stage. But Mrs. Brown can't really exist in Centra buying a sandwich. Do you understand what I mean? Whereas drag queens, they exist within the real world. They're getting taxis, they're performing in bars and nightclubs and hanging out with the people and chatting to everybody. You know, they're living in the real world. And that's why they are, you know, so rooted in the person that's playing them, because they're not scripted. Mrs. Brown is a script, so he's playing this role. But once the, you know, she comes off stage, she's back to being Brendan O'Carroll, mm-hmm. who happens to be in makeup and a wig, but he's Brendan O'Carroll. Whereas the drag queen is interacting with people unscripted all the time, because that's the milieu that a drag queen generally works in.
I mean, not obviously
in the show that I'm doing, The Peacock, mm-hmm. but in general, that's the kind of world that drag queens are running in.
Is it symbolically important then that you're playing at the Abbey? Because that really means that, you know, you are part of Irish life, that Panty is part of Irish life.
Well, it's funny, I didn't think it was, because to me it's just really, it's sort of another gig. You know, and I've done these theatre shows before, but everybody else seems to definitely view it in this sort of, oh my God, you've been accepted by mainstream Ireland or something. You know, people keep asking me about that. So that hadn't really entered my mind until everyone else started going on about
Well, you know,
like, oh my God, maybe I should be taking this more seriously.
Well, Panty isn't your typical Irish comely maiden. You know, it's something very new.
I know that the Abbey is seen as very traditional, but then I've seen lots of pretty out there stuff on the Abbey stage too. So, so I think it certainly seems to other people to be some sort of big deal that there's a drag queen doing a one-woman show in the hallowed halls of the Abbey. So maybe I should start seeing it that way. But until recently, I was just treating it as another fun gig. And, you know, I'm really good at having a good time. I've spent 25 years, you know, encouraging people to have a good time. So I'm all good with that. You know, often I think people don't give other people credit for being able to like things outside of their usual kin. Like, normally I always find if somebody brings their mother or their grandmother to some show in a nightclub that I'm at, and, you know, you can tell that she, you know, granny's never been in any place like this before and it's all new to her, you know, they have such a great time. Especially, I think, older women, I think they've seen life, you know, so they tend to be less judgmental, you know, they're open to things. And I think people like to be a little shocked too, don't they? You know, people enjoy that.
Well, Rory, tell me about the clubs then and how different they are to the theatre.
There's a lot of distractions in a nightclub. And of course, lots of the people there haven't really come specifically to see you. They're just out on their big night out. They're buying drinks, there's chatting, people are flirting with each other, people are having, you know, dramas, boyfriends are arguing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot going on. People are getting up and going to the toilet. So you can't really do things that are subtle in that atmosphere. Everything kind of has to be big. You kind of have to grab people's attention. And of course, there are drunk people too, and you have to learn how to deal with hecklers and all of that.
Are you expecting that to happen in the theatre then, hecklers?
See, that's what's so different about the theatre shows is, and in a way it's a bit more daunting, but I actually also find it very freeing, that in the theatre, everyone knows how they're expected to behave. All of the seats are facing, you know, the stage. People aren't getting up and going to the toilet. They're not, you know, talking amongst themselves once the lights go down. All of the focus is on you.
But we'll come back to talking more about Panty in a while. But I want to find out more about you, Rory. Mm-hmm. So, because you didn't arrive suddenly on stage as the full regalia Panty from a fairy tale. You're from Mayo. Whereabouts in Mayo are you from?
I'm from a town, Ballinrobe, which I'm sure you, being a Mayo woman, must know.
I do, because I'm only from 8 miles down the road.
Yes.
Were your parents from Ballinrobe originally, Rory?
No. Well, if you ask my dad where he's from, he would have difficulty answering that because his father was a guard and they moved around a lot. And my mother, her parents were Irish, but her father was a vet and he had moved to England. There was a big foot and mouth disease outbreak. So she was born in England and lived there till she was 12. Her father then passed away, so leaving her mother alone as a single mother with 5 children to raise on her own. And then she moved them back to Dublin and she grew up in Dolphin's Barn.
It must have been very difficult for your grandmother to raise five children
really
at that time.
Tough thing to do, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how did your mum and dad meet?
So my dad was in college studying to be a vet and so was my mother's brother. They were friends in college. And my dad actually came to take my aunt out to like some event, to a dance or whatever. I guess my uncle had arranged it. But instead, he ended up falling in love with my mother.
On that night, did he end up taking your aunt to the dance?
Well, I don't think it happened on that night, but she obviously caught his eye that night.
Your auntie must have been disgusted.
Oh, my auntie did fine. 7 different men proposed to her, so she was grand.
So they ended up settling in Ballinrobe, mm-hmm. and you and your siblings grew up there.
Yeah.
And where do you come in the family, Rory?
I'm number 5 of 6. We always joke that it was very Brady Bunch and very like my parents to be so well organized because it's boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. So I'm the last boy.
And tell me about this first song that we're going to play because it brings you right back to Ballinrobe in the 1980s. You're a big Michael Jackson fan.
So many people were big Michael Jackson fans in the 1980s, but I first grew up listening to the kind of music that my older brothers and sisters were listening to. But the first artist that I became, sort of interested in on my own, sort of, was Michael Jackson. But of course, when the Thriller album came out, I was at my teenage music peak. So Thriller was the first album that I spent my own money on. You know, I became quite obsessed with him, in the way teenagers do. And I remember even when I was sick at home once and he was on the cover of Time magazine. It was quite a big deal at the time for like this pop star to be on the cover of Time. I remember, when you were sick and your mother goes out and buys you comics or whatever to keep you amusing. And I was like, no, you have to buy me Time magazine. And she bought me a copy of Time magazine, which is still somewhere in the back of some drawer.
Oh, that's lovely. Why Billie Jean then, Rory?
It's all down to do with the bass line. I love a great bass line in a song, and I think the bass line in Billie Jean is one of the all-time great bass lines, like from the very beginning. Doon, 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 doon. It's absolutely, doesn't it make everybody want to start moving? I love it.
That was Michael Jackson, which brings you back to the 1980s and to Ballinrobe. Was it a happy childhood?
Yeah, very much. My dad was a vet and my mother was, a great mother. And I get on well with all of my siblings. And so it was very sort of idyllic, small country town.
And would you say that you fit into Ballinrobe? And I only ask you that because when you said your parents aren't from there, I imagine that you might have felt a bit like a blow-in.
I wouldn't say that I felt like a blow-in, but I do think, or certainly I felt, I don't know that all my brothers and sisters would say the same, but I definitely felt slightly disconnected. There was always this thing, and I think it's in small towns then, I don't know that it's so true now, where the vet and the doctor and the bank manager were kind of seen in a sort of separate way a little bit or something. Certainly I felt that, but that might have been tied up also, I suspect, maybe with just me being gay as well and not necessarily being into, I wasn't into the football and the hurling and all of that. And so I just always felt slightly, not in a big major way, I had a really happy, fun childhood. Mm-hmm. But I definitely, as I started to get older, I started to feel that a little more. And then I went to boarding school. when I was 12. And I think then that sort of sealed that deal in a way, where I always felt like I was just visiting Ballinrobe rather than living there. And when I did go home, I feel like, you know, my parents' house is my home. But Ballinrobe, I didn't have the same connections that, say, my sisters who went to school there and mm-hmm. all of that. You know, they're very connected to it. And I just never felt quite the same way. Yeah, and I've never been the homesick type. Like when I went to boarding school when I was 12, I never spent a single night feeling weird or homesick. I was just, this is where I am now, so I'll be fine with this. And, you know, you could call home whenever you wanted. Whereas, you know, other boys, you know, you'd hear them crying at nighttime, very unhappy.
And was it around that time then, Rory, that you began to realise that you were gay?
Probably. It seems so weird to say it now, but even then, you know, in the 80s, early 80s, you know, we didn't really know what gay was. I mean, I think kids now have no understanding of that because they have the internet and, you know, Graham Norton's on the TV. You know, they know so much about the world and about those, you know, sexuality and those kind of things. We really didn't know those things. So I didn't really know what gay was. The idea that I might be gay wasn't something I could grasp or understand. But I definitely felt that there was something different about me. I just mightn't have been able to put my finger on exactly what that was. Definitely... It was a slow burning realization that I was different, and then what that difference was mm-hmm. took a while for me to work out. I remember my parents had a book by Desmond Morris, the anthropologist, called Man Watching, I think it was called. And in it, there was a section on human sexuality, and within that, there was a small section on homosexuality. And I can remember reading that book and getting that section, and it was like a light going on. Oh my God, that's what I am. And it seemed so thrilling and exciting to me, even though it's written in this really, you know, cold, austere, just, you know, prose. You know, it's very academic. But to me, it seemed so exciting. I was like, oh, my God, this incredible discovery.
Why was it exciting? Because it must have been difficult as well to realize.
Well, I think like every young person realizing that there's something very different. I didn't want to be different. I did not want to be gay. And so I definitely struggled with that for a while. But the overriding factor was just kind of a relief and sort of, this is what the thing is. This is what the problem is. And maybe also because what I found particularly exciting about that thing in Desmond Morris was because it was sort of this, you know, academic tome, there was no judgment. It wasn't judgmental. He was just presenting facts. So there was no judgment in me. You know, maybe if I'd read something else, I might have had difficulty. But this was just laying down sort of, you know, the facts. I mean, I have such a strong sort of memory of that. And of course, kids nowadays must think that just sounds so archaic, you know, when they can go on the internet and God only knows what they can watch at the click of a mouse, you know.
Well, as you're explaining to, or as you're talking to me there, Rory, it sounds like it was quite isolated, your experience.
If you're, 13, 14 years old, 15 years old in Ballinrobe, County Mayo, there, as far as you're concerned, you're the only gay in the world. There's no Graham Norton on the TV. The only gay on the TV was your man in Are You Being Served, who was just the butt of like ridiculous joke, and he was this flaming camp queen. So I had just nothing to compare it to. And the only time gay was ever even mentioned was in the odd sort of horrible joke that might go around the schoolyard or something. Mm-hmm. So that it took quite a while for that to all work itself out.
So it's one thing then realizing that you were gay. How did you go about telling people? Did you tell friends first or family first?
By the time I was sort of confident enough to come out, I was in my first year, I think, in art college. So I would have been 18. And I started by telling my college friends. And it was a real relief and exciting. And I think many young gay people when it came out, you know, because I think you've spent all of these years worrying about something or not fitting in and wondering out what the problem is and then realizing what the problem is, that when you do sort of come out, it's such a relief and it's such a sort of a new dawn in a way. That for the first while, you become the gayest person in the world because you're just so thrilled to finally have all this worked out and this is who you are and what the problems were before. And so, you know, I think I, like so many young gay people, you know, for a while, I just became the gayest person in the world. You know, I was going to put sequins on everything and, you know, it was all I could think about.
Was it different than telling your family about it?
I first told my oldest sister, And my older sister, she had that reaction that I think a lot of people had. Oh, let's not tell Mammy and Daddy, because they don't need to. It'll only upset them. Now, of course, that's an impossible and silly, but that's a lot of people's first reaction. So we didn't tell my parents until later. And we decided that the perfect way to do it is a letter, which sometimes people think, oh, isn't that sort of a cowardly way, or shouldn't you sit down and tell them? No, don't sit down and tell them. Send them a letter, because, like I said, it might have taken you a few years to work it out for yourself and become okay with who you are. So if you sit down in front of your parents, and yes, some parents have an idea already, but lots of parents, you'll be amazed, have no idea. And you suddenly say to them, hi, ma'am, hi, dad, I'm gay. And then expect them at that very moment to have the perfect thing to say and to say the exact right thing. Whereas in reality, they might say something that, given a week to think about it, they would never have said, or, you know. So I think if you send them a letter, they have time to digest it, take in the information, and then think it through, and then respond. You know, it's unfair to expect, you know, a family member to just immediately be the perfect Hollywood parent about it. Well, that was the plan, but that's not what happened. One day, I'm actually in the car with my mother, and she said something that I misconstrued. I thought what she was saying was like saying, I know you're gay, so why don't you just come out and tell me? I don't even remember what it was she said, but something she said, I totally misread. So I was like, oh, well, yeah, I am gay. And that is not what she had meant at all. She nearly crashed the car.
Oh, your poor mother.
Yeah.
Was she in complete shock?
I think so, yes. And actually, we didn't really discuss it for a few days. She sort of sat on it for a few days. And I think, like so many parents, it was a shock, and it took her a little while to think through it. And then she spoke one day to her brother, who's a priest in England. And in many ways, he's sort of her best friend, too. You know, they're very close. Well, I don't know what he said to her, but whatever, it did the trick. And so then that day, we sort of spoke about it. She was a little upset because it's not how she imagined, you know, my life going or whatever. And she did the worry thing that mothers do. Mm-hmm. She kind of worried that I was going to grow up old and lonely or something. You know, that's just what mothers do, isn't it?
Well, tell me about your dad, though. How did you tell him then?
Well, I also feel so guilty about this, because I think it's hard not to imagine that maybe your dad is going to react badly, because he's your dad and there's that whole male thing tied up in it all, isn't there? So I couldn't help but have those fears, even though I know my dad is, you know, smart and lovely, and he's incredibly laid back man. So I, you know, in retrospect, why did I have those fears? But I did, of course I did. And when I was talking to my mother about it finally after those few days, and we're sort of sitting in her room, then we heard my dad drive in, and my mother went out and told him in the car. And I sort of sat in the living room for those few minutes, like, absolutely. And then my dad walked in, and he just said, well, don't you be worrying about what I think. It's all fine. And from the first second, he was absolutely, totally and utterly okay and cool with it. And actually, for years, I thought that it was fake. I thought, he can't have dealt with it that easily. And I suspected, oh, I bet you he just decided, oh, you know, my wife's upset about this, so to be helpful, I'll just act like it's the most normal, easy thing in the world. That's what I really suspected. I thought he had decided to be that way about it for my mother's sake. But I've asked him about it since, and he always says, no, I just...
It was totally fine.
I mean, maybe I think, sometimes I think when you're a vet and you just sort of see the natural world as it is, you know, you don't have many illusions about things.
Do you regret then delaying and telling them, Rory?
I wouldn't say that I regret delaying in, because I don't think it had any long-term consequences or anything. But I do feel slightly guilty in retrospect for worrying, you know.
But then you've described telling that you're HIV positive, mm-hmm. like a second coming out, and it being more difficult to tell to people than that you were a gay man. So tell me, first of all, when did you discover that you were HIV positive?
I was diagnosed in 1995. See, isn't that a weird thing? I think most people would really remember that, the exact date or something, and I don't, but it was 1995, I think, in the middle of the summer. And it definitely came as a big shock. I wasn't expecting it. And my what I actually remember is my poor GP, who's a really lovely man, and I could see that he was finding this an incredibly difficult situation to have to tell me, because of course, you know, things have changed so much now, but at the time it was a death sentence. He was giving you a death sentence, and so of course it was an absolutely massive and huge thing for me, and I had been to AIDS funerals and knew people who died, and you know, I knew exactly what he was telling me. There was no, I was under no illusions, and I had grown up at the time, you know, when there was headstone ads on the TV and all of that stuff. But you know, I even amaze myself when I think about it that I didn't super freak out about it, but it was definitely a huge big shock. And so I can remember leaving my doctor's office, and I was like, wow, okay, so how long am I here for, was sort of the question.
So you're leaving the doctor's office. Tell me, what's going through your head? How are you feeling?
I think I was probably stunned, and it was this, it was like today, you know, it was like perfect sunny summer afternoon, and I was just like in a total daze. Now, at the time, I was living with two friends of mine, so I was just like, okay, I need to tell somebody. And But at the time, as soon as you were diagnosed, you were swept into this world. And this world was about managing, essentially about managing your demise. That's how it felt. So the next thing you know, you're in the clinic, you know, in my case, in James's. And, you know, they have this, you know, you're seeing the doctor and they're talking about all the different options.
And
then
the
next thing,
like?
You have your appointment with the social worker who's telling you about, you can get a blanket allowance because they're assuming you won't be able to work. And, you know, it was kind of a... They were just, that's the feeling. The feeling was, okay, you're now on this, you know, conveyor belt, and this conveyor belt is leading towards a funeral, and we're just going to make that easy. That's how it felt to me, and I think to everybody else. And of course, the clinic was full of very sick people, and people were dying. But I was very lucky. I'm the personality type that I am. I didn't freak out, and I just, okay, I'm going to deal with this. I often joke in the clinic, you know, that, oh, I'm magic, because I never felt that I was going to, I think... Part of me never believed I was going to get sick. And I was very lucky to be diagnosed when I was, because not long after, within a couple of years, you know, the new treatments started to appear. And at first they were difficult. There was, you know, there was a lot of side effects and all that. But, you know, as the years went by, treatments got better and better and better. And, you know, and now, you know, I was right. I'm not dying, you know.
Rory,
I was right. You were all wrong.
You're telling me this story and you've got a smile on your face. Like, it's fascinating because you're so strong about it. I think I would have crumbled with the hopelessness of the situation.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that is a weird thing about me. I sometimes think that myself. I don't look back in that and think of this horrible, awful time, which I know sounds so ridiculous. But I just, part of me always believed, you know, I'm not that person. I'm going to be fine. Of course, there was moments, and I had dark moments, but you know, I can very clearly remember the first, you know, I don't know if it was the very first visit to the clinic in James's or one of them, when you have to go and see a social worker, and she's talking away at me about, you know, the assumption being that I'm not going to be working anymore, and I'm going to be, you know, and they're very careful about the fear around it. They all understand the prejudice around it. So they are just assuming that you're going to be finishing work, that you're going to be on the dole, and here's the allowances you can get. You can get allowance for your blankets, and you can get allowance for your heat. And all of that just seemed like she was talking about another person. So...
Well, can I ask, because you were obviously dealing with it very well and staying very positive. How did your family deal with it, though, when you told them that you were HIV positive?
Well, so in a weird way, that is like, it's like a second coming out, because it's this other huge thing you have to tell them. And I guess in a way I was more worried, if that's possible, about this, because I knew that this wasn't something that they could get over, because I was telling them, your son is going to die at the time. That's what I was telling them. Now, I didn't tell them straight away. So by the time I did tell them, I had a good grasp on what exactly was happening to me. And I think I was, you know, some of the new treatments had just started to come out. So I was able to paint a picture that wasn't...
As grim as it could have been.
As grim as it could have been, maybe.
But you're still telling your mother, basically, that you have a terminal disease.
Yeah. But again, my parents are sort of amazing, and they just took that on board. And I think probably because of the period that it was when I told them that I was gay, I suspect that this is something they might have even thought about. Because at the time, you know, being HIV positive was so associated with gay people. You know, and it's funny now when you go to the clinic now, you know, it's such a different range of people. But mm-hmm. back then, so maybe they'd given some thought or worried about that as a possibility before. So maybe in a weird way, they had slightly prepared them for Zelda, because again, they were very strong about it, very good about it.
So you didn't have any sense of letting them down.
I definitely had that. That's what the fear was. I think when I was telling them I was gay, I felt like this has nothing to do with me. I'm just telling them this is who I happen to be. Whereas I did feel I had, I think, you know, taken on some of the shaming that was around, you know, being HIV positive at the time, and or that's still around it. I just couldn't help but probably have assimilated that. And part of me did feel, you know, I had maybe, you know, I'd let them down in some way by, you know, that this was, you know, a sign of my own stupidity or, you know, and because at the time it was such a death sentence, I did only, I'm about to put them through a whole, you know, heap of pain. Mm-hmm. And I felt really guilty about that. I felt that, you know, my other brothers and sisters hadn't done this to them. And now I was doing this to them, and I did feel, yeah, this is an awful thing to be telling your parents, and
because there was a huge stigma attached to HIV.
Massive, there still is. I mean, even in places that you think shouldn't be, like in the gay community, where people should be so, you know, knowledgeable, really, especially with younger gays, because they haven't grown up with all of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real stigma about it, and sort of a shaming about it. I mean, I had to sort of stop looking online sometimes at these forums and things because of the things that, you know, even, you know, I can take it when some crazy, you know, nut, you know, religious, you know, nut or something says awful things about gay people and about HIV and all that. I can take that. It's water off a duck's back. Who cares? But it is upsetting and depressing when you see gay people saying it about other gay people.
But I was surprised to read recently that the figures of people who are being diagnosed mm-hmm. with HIV are actually increasing in Ireland.
Yeah, they are. And I think that's, I think that's two reasons. One is sort of complacency, because now it is seen as sort of a chronic manageable condition, that you don't have all of those education campaigns and, you know, there aren't those ads on the TV and all that. And young people have never known anybody who died of AIDS and they've never been to an AIDS, you know. So there has become, you know, this, they're much more complacent. But I think a lot of it is to do with the stigma around it, because if everybody who is HIV positive was open about the fact that they are, it's a very difficult thing to do. And I'm not saying that, I'm not blaming anybody for not being that, because there's a lot of stigma and it's a very difficult thing to have to tell someone or be open about. But if everyone who was open about it, everyone's attitude would change overnight, because you all know people who are HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And so all these young gay guys, they think it is not even in their life. They think it's this weird thing that older gays used to have to worry about. That's how they sort of view it. Whereas if they went along to the clinic one day, they'd see so many people their own age and people that they know probably. But because people feel they have to keep quiet about it because of this stigma. So if people stop blaming people for it, the situation would be much better.
Do your generation then have a certain burden to bear because you had to deal with the AIDS deaths and with so many people being diagnosed with HIV, and that's very different, as you're describing, to the younger generation?
Yes. I mean, this seems like an odd thing to say, but in many ways it was a positive experience for the gay community, which seems like such a ridiculously awful thing to say, because it was horrible. People were dying and dying really horrible deaths, and, you know, they weren't passing away in some sort of Hollywood, you know, glow. There were awful, long, painful deaths, and people's families were devastated, and people had to, while that was happening, they also had to deal with horrible stigma and all of that. But in a weird way, it also brought the gay community together, and it really, I think the gay community found a strength and a voice then that they hadn't had before, because suddenly they had to fight this. Well, because other people weren't fighting this and governments were doing nothing about it and everything. So the gay community around the world really found a strength and a to to take on this huge, massive thing. Mm-hmm. And in a way, maybe the gay community before that had been seen just as a collection of bars and nightclubs. Whereas suddenly, it was much more than that. They were looking after each other. They were making meals for each other. They were having, you know, creating housing organizations. They were fighting for treatments. You know, it was a massive thing. Mm-hmm. And in a way, and I know this sounds awful, but in a way, a lot of good things came out of it too. I don't want to in any way diminish the awfulness of it, but that's all. There's also that side of it.
Is there a certain amount of unresolved grief then from all the people that did die, like friends of yours that did pass away?
I don't know, though. I would say there's, on a personal level, any unresolved grief. But I do think that sometimes for some older gays, when younger gay people are so blasé, or they, you know, most 20-year-old gay guys now, they have no understanding of what happened and what it was like. And I think in a small way, that can be not depressing, but it's a little difficult sometimes to deal with for, you know, guys who are, say, 50. Mm-hmm. And all the things that they had to go through, and seeing friends die, and you know, it was a massive experience for people of that generation. And then sometimes maybe you see these younger gay people, and you kind of feel you want to shake them and say, "But you're only able to be like this because of the horrible things that we had to go through." And yeah,
is there a divide then between?
I wouldn't say divide, but it's like anything, isn't it? All older people always think younger people don't appreciate what they had to go through. But so in a way, I think there's that kind of sometimes feeling in the gay community that this really awful, horrible thing happened, and younger gays, thank God and great for them, have no idea of how awful it was.
Tell me, Rory, it's 18 years now since you were diagnosed with HIV. So how have you got through it?
Well, like I said, I do have this ability to not worry about things. And I don't want to be sound wishy-washy, and some doctors out there are probably going to about to clasp their heads and groan or something. But I think a positive attitude has really been helpful to me. I mean, I do always joke and say, oh, I'm magic. You know, I'm not, you know, it's all going to be fine. And in a way, that has all worked out. Now, I know that it's all worked out because there are great doctors in St. James's and great nurses in St. James's, and they look after everybody so very well, and there's been great advances in treatments, and things have just changed so much. I can't even begin to describe to you how it's changed.
And our next piece of music is from Dolly Parton.
I absolutely love Dolly Parton. You know, I listen to Dolly songs all the time. In a way, like a sort of drag, she's a perfect entertainment character because she has this incredible musical ability, incredible talent, but at the same time, she doesn't feel she has to beat you over the head with it. She's fun, she's, you know, light about it. And I just love all those things about her. Yeah. She's a good time girl, and I recognize that in myself.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you can.
That was Jolene from Dolly Parton, chosen by my guest this morning, Rory O'Neill, who's better known as Panty and is currently playing at the Peacock at the Abbey Theatre with her new show, All Dolled Up, Restitched. Rory, can you tell me about our next piece of music, which is a lovely, happy piece, This Will Be, from Natalie Cole?
Yes, an old favourite of mine. When I first started doing drag, I was in art college, and the first character I used to do was like very artsy. You know, I'd make costumes out of rubber gloves and, you know, that kind of stuff. But when I moved to Japan, I thought, oh, well, this is my chance to actually change and do a different character. So I started doing Panty in the early 90s in Tokyo, and on our first big nightclub show, I did this number. So when I hear this song, it really brings me back to that time being young and running around Tokyo doing this drag, crazy drag act. And this song, yeah, I have such a clear mind. I don't remember what I was wearing.
What were you wearing? Tell me.
It was sort of a silver sequined number, you know, sort of long 70s Farrah Fawcett hair. I wasn't a blonde then, but eventually all drag queens go blonde.
That was Natalie Cole with This Will Be. You know, you've played in those small clubs to massive stages. You've been, you know, in the gay pride parades, in the St. Patrick's Day parades.
You and parades.
No, but you know, this is all everything that you're part of. Yeah. You know, Panty's now kind of a central part of Dublin. Is it important that you keep pushing the boundaries with Panty?
Well, I think I'd get bored if I didn't. I mean, you know, I have my bar, Panty Bar, on Capel Street, and I perform there regularly, and like I do a show there every Saturday. But, you know, you'll get bored doing anything for a long time. Or not exactly bored, but, you know, you want to do other things, don't you? So I really enjoy doing the theatre shows as well, because it's just a different outlet and I can do things that I can't do in my regular show. And also, it's doing your regular show, it's very much, it's all about you. Whereas it's fun for me to then go into this theatre situation where you're surrounded by these professionals who all have their jobs to do and it's all worked out to the finest detail. It's just a very different experience and you know, I like that too.
And you strike me as a very worry-free person.
I've always been that way. I mean, I have this... I don't worry about things, and if things are beginning to worry, I literally can just push them back to the back of my mind. And I think most of the time that's a bonus, that's a positive thing, because you know, you can to not be a worrier and not to let things stress you too much. But sometimes though, it's also, there's a downside. Sometimes I think I always end up, you know, deadlines, I'm always at the very last minute or they're late because I'm so not worried about it that I haven't started the work I should have. But why I'm that way, I don't know. I've always been like that. My dad's incredibly laid back. I mean, I can barely ever remember my father, say, raising his voice, let alone being properly angry. And on top of that, then my mother's also very practical. You know, if there was a crisis, you'd want my mother, you know, to be organizing it. You'd want my dad to be keeping everybody calm and my mother to be deciding the plan of action. And I think maybe I got a bit of both of them or something. And also, I think probably partly to do with having a very secure upbringing. I never worried. I never had to worry as a kid.
That's a lovely thing to be able to say, I think, about your childhood.
Yeah, like, I look back at my childhood and I don't ever remember there being any worries.
And has this attitude equipped you well in life then?
Yeah, like everybody's life, there are, you know, bad things happen, or, you know, you have experiences that aren't pleasant. And I think I normally deal with them very well. My friends often say that to me when bad things happen. They, you know, to me, they always, well, at least it happened to you and not, you know, because, you know, other friends would have totally freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, our last piece of music is one that's going to get people dancing around their kitchen, Rory. Tell me, well, I suppose it's a bit obvious, but why did you choose Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes?
I love a song that has a story and or has really great imagery, especially to perform to or perform with. That's, you know, the kind of song you want. And again, it has that great opening, you know, that everybody loves.
Well, thank you very much, Rory O'Neill, for being my guest on Even and Company.
Thank you.
Play, All Dolled Up, Restitched, runs until next Saturday at the Peacock Theatre here in Dublin. It's going to be a great show and fun for grown-ups.
And it's funny, because I know for me, this talk has been a little depressing at times, but the show's funny.
It's funny and colourful. On sound today was Cara O'Hare. Research was by Jerry Philpott. And this programme is produced by Eileen Hearn. By me live, Egan Amsha and Shaken Shahugan. Until then, thank you very much for listening and a very good morning.
Her hair is hollow gold, her lips sweet surprise, her hands are never cold, she's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll turn her music on you, you won't have to think twice, she's pure as New York snow, she got Betty Davis eyes.
Evening and Company on RTE Radio 1. Podcast the show at rte.ie/radio player.